Hello, my name is Saul Albert. I'm from Queen Mary University London in the Computer Science Department. I'm one of PAC's PhD students in the final death throes of my PhD. I've just written a paper not on my PhD subject, which is a nice little relief. So I'm going to present the findings, or the central findings of that paper, which is on joint improvisation, choreography, and social action in partner dance. So I'm going to talk about improvisation and non-improvisation, and why it's difficult to make an empirical distinction between these on a theoretical basis. Then I'm going to show how, in practice, partner dancers and their audiences make those kinds of distinctions in very ordinary ways through their embodied involvement and rhythmical coordination during a musical partner dance performance. And then I'm going to propose that by observing embodied human interaction in each specific research setting, we can find some useful distinctions between improvisation and non-improvisation grounded in participants' own practical actions and orientations. So it's really important to be able to distinguish between improvisation and non-improvisation in empirical terms, because clear understanding of improvisation is central to understanding how we analyse musical score. How analysis of musical scores or fixed choreographies are transformed and interpreted into experiences and action during live performances. And these are always contingent on the constraints of the current situation. And issues of improvisation are also central to cognitive theories of creativity and how set patterns and established practices evolve new phenomena through the kind of accidental contingencies of live interaction. And also studies of interaction and cognition, like Michael's and Pat's, look at how shared understandings emerge from performers' ongoing evaluations of their joint interpretations and responses to one another. But most studies in improvisation, both in aesthetics and philosophy and the social sciences, tend to treat improvisation as a genre. So we take it as read that when we call something improvisation, it's improvised. But that doesn't necessarily take into account to what extent and in what particular ways the structures that are evolving there are new to each participant. So these kind of conventional definitions have been criticized, certainly in the aesthetics of dance, for reflecting culturally specific, sometimes quite ethnocentric norms in distinguishing between composed and improvised activities. And so the way that I'm proposing to make this distinction between improvisation and non-improvisation is as a practice, so drawing on phenomenological studies of rhythm and improvisation in ethnography and ethnomethodological studies of embodied action that are kind of situated in everyday naturalistic environments. So the setting I'm going to talk to you about today is drawn from a YouTube video of a social dance performance. I'm going to show it, and then I'm going to explain how I'm approaching this analytically. So what we're going to see is these dancers, Michael and Frieda, and audience members, including Kevin and Joe here, involved in a Lindy Hop performance, which is a contemporary version of vernacular dance created by African-American dancers in the 20s and 30s in Harlem, dancing to sort of swing-era jazz. So these two professionals are in a Jack and Jill competition. Dance partners are selected at random. They've got a couple of seconds to get with the music, and then they have to start dancing together in front of a massive group of people. So it's... So you can kind of hear the audience behind them, also mostly dancers. This is a dance camp, and they're clapping and cheering behind the camera. And the thing to point out here is that Lindy Hop's a lead-follow-partner dance. So that means that there's a partner in the lead role here. Michael initiates a movement, and somebody in the follow role here is Frieda, chooses how to respond. And these were traditionally gendered roles. It's not that way anymore. Most advanced dancers both lead and follow. And there seems to be a sort of creative hierarchy implicit in those definitions, but the way that the leader leads a movement kind of depends on how the follow partner follows the movement. So it's quite difficult to make those distinctions in practice. I'm just going to... once the dance gets going, then it's kind of a conversation, and based on those kinds of constraints. I'm just going to show this from a... it's quite hard to control this video. I'm just going to show a specific section of this, which is the 10 seconds I'm going to concentrate on this. Here we go. (Laughs)
So that's the section I'm going to concentrate on in this presentation. What I want you to think about here are some of the interactional resources that are being used to organize this kind of participation. So I think one of the things that I've already touched on a little bit is the lead-follow dynamic and how this constitutes a participation framework, essentially, where the lead-follow roles, reciprocal processes through which the partners manage these kinds of contingencies, happen when one partner initiates and another responds to the other's action, observing one another carefully, and the dancers kind of track each other to make sense of the emerging structure of the activity in progress, track what other parties and the audience members are doing in the space, and then manage the kind of resulting contingencies that emerge for the trajectory of their own actions. So some of the other key resources here, I've already said we have this kind of lead-follow dynamic. Excuse me for the slightly silly graphic, but there you go. And this framework that is kind of led and followed conversationally also includes the audience members. And they're sitting in a kind of spatial convention of a semicircle on the floor, forming this kind of ad hoc stage. And they're clapping chorally in time with each other, as you could hear from the clip. And by doing these things, they uphold the overall structure of the performance as such. So if one of them were to get up and walk around in the middle of the space, like through the O space that Pat was talking about earlier, this would be publicly accountable as an interruption of the performance. So by upholding this framework, other kinds of resources also become available, including rhythmical resources, such as the structure of the music, the choral clapping. And these rhythms correspond to learned patterns and structures of footworks, kind of set pieces, which anyone who's danced the Lindy Hop would recognize as kind of standards that the dancers bring with them into the space and to varying degrees are familiar with these kinds of movements. So I'm going to talk about some of these resources, especially the conventional structures that you guys might not be familiar with. I'm a Lindy Hop dancer, so I am. Possibly the most conventional learned footwork pattern of them all in the Lindy Hop is the swing out. And here you can see William Downs and Francis Jones, members of Whitey's Lindy Hoppers, in Hell's a Poppin', which is a 1941 film, doing a swing out next to the Michael and Frieda swing out you just watched. And these kind of set piece moves have a familiar structure of initiation and response. Dancers can project what's coming next. And there's also a kind of set rhythmical pattern that fits within the conventional phrasing of the music. So the swing out takes 8 beats, and it involves a more or less set pattern of footfalls in a repeating periodic rhythm. And it takes 2 bars to complete, which constitutes a kind of quarter of a 32-beat phrase within a 32-bar AABA American Songbook swing orchestration. So these are kind of conventional structures you have to learn by participating in these environments and learning these things. And dancers can use and deploy these structures as set-piece choreographic things to help coordinate joint movements and manage the contingencies of live interaction and unexpected activities. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the rhythmical structures in particular, because I think they provide especially clear evidence of how participants experience improvisation and non-improvisation in this setting. And to do that, we need to sort of describe rhythms rather accurately. I also think it's a useful interdisciplinary kind of focal point where lots of people will be able to relate to rhythms as in different ways, as a regularity. So this table distinguishes between rhythmical structures of common activities and how they sort of relate to one another. So we have aperiodic rhythms. Like most bodily movements and twitches, they don't follow a regular repeating periodic pattern. We were doing some clapping earlier. We can't predict these patterns necessarily. And then we have periodic patterns like a steady walking place or a regular clapping rhythm, which do hearably repeat and can easily be used for projecting and anticipating timing in the absence of other coordination mechanisms. So rhythms can either be uncoupled, like walking on your own, which has no sort of observable causal relationship to some other activity. And then there's uncoupled rhythms. And then there's coupled rhythms, like group rowing or this clapping we were hearing, or moving a sofa where the movement's coupled by a sofa. And Chauvignier points out that partner dancing is an especially useful setting to study rhythmical coordination because dancers have to work not only to project and synchronize with the rhythm of the music, they also have to stay in sync with their partners and their partners' visible body actions. So this is a really useful moment in terms of when these kinds of coordinations falter, where we can see partners working to regain coordination between their ostensibly sort of internal timing and the external rhythms in the music or the clapping, and how they maintain their accountable roles in the participation framework that we've just described. So I'm going to be focusing on how rhythmical patterns are coordinated to provide insights into how these experiences and methods of participation are organized in this setting. So I'm going to play you a couple of clips. The first one is a microcosm of the following 3 clips. It starts with a familiar learned footwork pattern. Then there's a moment of unfamiliar movement, and then it returns to a familiar pattern. I want you to focus on the dancers first, and you'll see Michael leading a familiar movement, Frida following it, and then Frida sort of orienting to Michael in a way that breaks off from the flow of the dance and does something else, displays a response. So now we want you to watch it again, watch the audience. I want you to watch Jo and her clapping. Clapping in rhythm. Something happens. Oh. And then she starts clapping again. Also at that point, what you'll see is that these Peter, Kevin and Mikey display their responses to one another. Karen puts her arm on Laura's lap. There's a breaking off. So I'm using this as a kind of an empirical starting point for the analysis because there's a segmentation based on the audience's actions. Now I'm going to show you a larger segment, also an improvisation sandwich. We're going to start focusing on the dancers. They're doing a swing out and a pass by. So this is a piece that happens immediately after the last clip. And these are, I think, familiar movements. You'll see Frida is not attending to Michael in this process. She's not ready for any responding or changing. She seems to be orienting to this as part of a familiar pattern. So you can also at the same time focus on the audience and how that clapping resumes. So we see Kevin's clapping begins to have this kind of choral dynamic. So that's where I'm starting with this analysis. Then we're going to shift to a moment of improvisation. And I want you to really look at, this is the kind of cheese in the sandwich moment, where there's a kind of breakdown where Kevin stops clapping and one by one all of the audience members stop clapping as this bit of improvisation unfolds. And you'll see, look at Frida's face during it. It's classic. So I hope you all saw how some of the audience members were also able to follow this movement, kind of solving this like a puzzle that evolves with a set deadline, in a way, with this jump relating to maybe musical structures, maybe other kinds of structures in the movement. So finally, we're going to return to a spate of non-improvisation, and here we'll see the audience applauding and then returning to this kind of choral clapping, and we're going to see again these very classic moves, a swing out and a pass by. These are very well-established movements. So you can kind of hear that re-establishing itself. So the proposal I'm making is in the context of interdisciplinary study of joint improvisation is that a promising way to study this is to focus on various rhythmical structures that are established, disrupted, and resynchronized through this kind of participation framework between audience members and dancers. And this is a rough plot of just a few of the resources, a few of the different resources in the environment. We've got audible choral claps, Joe's clapping, Frida's footfalls, and Michael's footfalls. If we just look at these again, we have this nice regularity. You can hear the audience's clapping tail off. And then re-establish this kind of pattern. So just to revisit some of these rhythms, I think these differently organized rhythms are coupled in different ways to one another, and they become socially accountable phenomena as they shift from one to the other. And we can see some of these are projectable by virtue of having an internal regular periodic mechanism, some with reference to the interaction with a partner, and some others in relation to pre-existing structures of language, culture, rhythm, things that we learn about through our familiarity with these spaces. So the moments of shift, I'm suggesting, are moments where these methods of organizing human action in environments can tell us a lot about distinctions between improvisation and non-improvisation that are kind of native to these environments. So just a few conclusions. Obviously, I'm only focusing on kind of non-vocal resources, which is really complicated, and it has been a massive stretch trying to try and pull some analytical traction from these materials. And this is specific to a very limited setting. But what I've tried to do is just demonstrate that some of the ways we can make distinctions between improvisation and non-improvisation, that these are complicated things to do in theory. when we observe people in a naturalistic environment, we start to see how do they coordinate shift between different ways of organising joint human action, and that these give us some insight if we look at each particular setting into how we might then come up with an interdisciplinary way of observing those regularities that will provide us with an empirical distinction between improvisation and non-improvisation in participants' own terms.
Perfect timing. Let's give him an applause. And remember to write down a...